From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
I often say that the birds taught me to garden, and especially to make what I call a 365-day garden, a garden with something going on all the time. In hopes of attracting birds early on with fruit and nectar and shelter, in other words, with different things to match all their needs in different seasons, I inadvertently collected some really great multi-season plants that we now both enjoy, and about 60 species of birds visit the garden each year. As I grow older and patient enough to sit and look quietly and more closely, I'm learning the same lessons now about how other living things interact with plants, from smaller creatures, especially insects. We're all part of one big organism, aren't we? And we live in a habitat. Today's guest, Doug Tallamy, has been called the leader of the habitat gardening movement and is a professor in the Department of Entomology and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Delaware in Newark, where he has taught and conducts research. Along with Rick Dark, Doug is also co-author of a new book, The Living Landscape, and I'm so glad that he joins me today to talk about just that. Welcome, Doug. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm just in from the garden.
Good. It's raining here, so not me.
Oh, but that's a blessing in itself.
It is good for
everybody.
Yeah.
So I have been really enjoying the new book from Timber Press, The Living Landscape, that you're the co-author of, as I said. And it really speaks to a lot of possibilities, an approach to gardening that's not, as I say disparagingly about some styles of gardening, outdoor decorating. You're the sort of anti-outdoor decorating movement, I think.
Well, it'd be great if we could do both.
Yes.
There's no doubt plants are beautiful and everybody likes to see their beauty, and I'm not against that by any stretch, but plants do so many things that if we only look at what they look like, you know, if we only look at their decorative value, we're ignoring all those wonderful things they do. And we actually pay a heavy price for that. Yeah, they're entities that do things, and we need those functions, and we can enjoy them as well.
So in the preface of The Living Landscape, you and Rick Dark each write a preface kind of your own from your own perspective about this subject. And
right.
Yours really... I loved it because it gave me a glimpse of your garden, of your own home landscape. And I wonder if we could kind of tell that story in brief about the garden you have made where you live.
We live on 10 acres.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of these farms that was chopped up and sold. And we were looking for a more rural situation, so we grabbed it, put a house on it. But it had been mowed for hay for forever before we got there.
Yes.
It was taken out of mowing 3 years before we actually moved in. And what returned were not the grasses that they were mowing, but all the woody invasive species that are really common in our area.
Oh, I think I remember that stage at my place.
Yes. You know, it I always say it looked like Sleeping Beauty's castle, because it really did. You couldn't walk around. I mean, it was just choked with everything.
Yes.
So our immediate goal came to be just controlling those invasives. First, we cut paths. We were able to walk around and see what was out there. But it's been a constant constant upkeep trying to keep those plants out. But in the meantime, we encouraged the return of natives.
Mm-hmm.
I did not record, you know, what was living on that property when we moved in. We were just too busy. But I can tell you that now we have 54 species of birds that breed there.
That breed there.
Mm. Just about all we could probably squeeze in. And we have put many, many plants back. We focused on the woodies because we're actually returning it to the eastern deciduous forest that it wants to be. We do have a few meadow sections, but the focus of the landscape has been on restoration as opposed to fancy landscape design. I'm not a designer, so why bother? Fortunately, we are tucked out of the way. There's not a single other person that can see our landscape without coming down the long driveway. So we don't have the pressure, the public pressure that a lot of people have, and that does make it easier for us. It also that's because I'm lazy about things like that.
So you can be a little wild and shaggy, and that's all the better in a way. I mean,
if I miss that weekly mowing, it's not the end of the world. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you know the just fascinating part of this restoration is to see all of the things that have come back. And every year, we've been there 14 years now, and every year we find new things that we have never seen before. I am an entomologist, so you know, many of these are insects, but of course, if you provide insects, all the things that eat insects come as well. And it's just been wonderful fun to see the life, you know, taking hold again on this property that had been farmed literally for almost 400 years before we got there.
That's a long history of farming.
It is, yes.
Of submission, of making the land submit to regular cultivation or yeah. machinery and so forth. Wow, that's a long history.
All of the topsoil is in what we call the holler now. You know, long ago washed down into our little swampy area. But
well, I love what you say about, you know, kind of who shows up, depending on how you're managing the landscape or not managing it in some cases, you know. Who shows up, like this year for me, and each year is a little bit different. I feel like each year has its own starring characters. And, mm-hmm. you know, do you know what I mean? The ebbs and
Absolutely,
flows.
Yeah.
The ebbs and flows of populations. And, you know, I'm not an entomologist or a biologist, and I don't really know, but I read a lot, and I try to understand and puzzle apart a little bit. Like this year, I would call the year, for me, it's been the year of the, so far at least, as spring was the year of the, what is it, Narcissus americanus? Is that the big millipede, the big long one?
Oh, yeah.
So they were just on parade. I mean, it was like I had a marching band of them, you know, and they were just so busy. And I guess, you know, maybe the way that I've been doing what I've been doing for how long, which is that I use a lot of mulch and I try to keep all the good organic stuff, you know, on the beds. And, you know, there's lots of good litter, so to speak, to work
right.
with. I don't know. Maybe I'm a friendly millipede housing development.
Well, you probably also had a fair amount of rain last year.
I did.
All of these things come together and provide ideal conditions. And when that happens, you get population growth. So every population in the world goes up and goes down depending on whether the conditions are good or bad. And, you know, we as particularly entomologists have been struggling to predict when that's going to happen forever. We're not very good at it. But some years are really good. At our house last year, I call it the year of the caterpillar because
yes.
I'm always looking for caterpillars. But last year, not just at our house, up and down the East Coast, people were talking about all the different species that we had seen. I found caterpillars that I hadn't seen in 10 years.
And mm.
I remember in August, I stood under one of our young oak trees that we started from an acorn. It's now probably 20 feet tall, and just looked up without moving. And without moving, I found 11 caterpillars, and they belong to 6 different species. And I've never seen, you know, that type of diversity or
wow.
abundance before.
I have more moths. I've become attuned to moths the last couple of years since a book about them, I guess it's a Peterson's Guide to the Eastern Moths, came out maybe 2-3 years ago.
Well, Dave Wagner's?
Yes.
Oh, yes, there's that?
Yes,
right.
And Seabrook Lecky.
And also Dave Wagner's Caterpillars of Eastern
and
North
America.
And
that's a wonderful book. I love
yeah.
that book. And so that came maybe first, and then the next year or two
right.
years later, I think
right.
Seabrook Lecky's book came. And I've been more attuned, and the diversity of moths, which, of course, are related. I mean, the caterpillars and the moths and so forth. I mean, it's,
yeah,
yeah so it's amazing. I can go out some mornings and just resting on the side of one of the buildings will be, mm-hmm. you know, a dozen or more species, you know, that I can identify visually are different. I think, wow,
yeah.
how can this be? And I'm not even looking. I'm not even on the hunt, you know?
That's, you know, that the addition of these books to our libraries has been wonderful because it's made, you know, some of the most common animals that we have accessible to everybody else.
Yeah.
No longer are they just worms or, you know, ugly moths. We
right.
can actually put names on them. We can recognize them. We can understand what they're eating, why they're there, who depends on them. All of these things become accessible to us because we know what, you know, what their name is, really. They become our friends.
Right, and what they're looking for in our environments, which is where we were before, of course, I derailed us talking about who's
right.
showing up and the year of the
right.
millipede
right.
and so forth. But way back when everything was less disturbed and before all those invasives that your place and my place, which were both agricultural, were subjected to and so on and so forth and the successions that happened. Before all that, there were probably native things that these insects and other creatures co-evolved with in some way or developed with and that they like to eat or nest in or use in some way. And so a lot of people think, well, if I only plant natives, and you said you're emphasizing natives in your own landscape, that's going to be part of the solution or a large part of the solution. But you've kind of, in the new book, in The Living Landscape, you've taken that word, and instead of being like super, super strict about it, you have a more what I think of as a realistic definition of what native means.
Right. It's a functional definition as opposed to a geographic one.
Yes.
A lot of people think, you know, a native is a plant has always been in North America. But that would make a plant from California native in Delaware, and you know, ecologically, it's not.
I know.
So we're not trying to make native plant museums where we just gather them all and you know plant them and then we can look at them. We're trying to rebuild communities that as you said earlier co-evolve together.
Mm-hmm.
So our definition of native is you know it's a plant or an animal that has evolved in a particular place long enough to be able to establish the specialized relationships that are nature. Most of the relationships between plants and animals are highly specialized, and they take a long time to develop.
Right.
And this is the big problem with moving plants, particularly plants around, well, animals too, but when you move plants around the world, they enter a new area where they have not had the time to develop those specialized relationships. So the local insects typically can't eat them.
Right.
And all the things that depend on those insects disappear as well because there's nothing generating those insects.
Mm-hmm.
The plant will grow just fine there, but it hasn't developed those relationships that build community structure and the diversity and abundance that supports, you know, these living landscapes. And that takes time. It just does. It doesn't mean that our non-native plants will never develop these relationships, but we're talking about many hundreds of years, thousands of years for them to develop, not, you know, a few weeks or a few years.
Right. A friend, a biologist friend came. He wrote a book called Tracks and Sign of Insects. I don't know if you know that book, but it's an interesting book about galls and cocoons and I don't know.
Yeah,
all
I don't know that.
Yeah. Oh, it's very good. Tracks and Sign of Insects and Other Invertebrates. It's only 2 years old. But anyway,
okay.
I'll email you about it. It's amazing.
Thanks.
And so it's the most curious thing. And so he's an expert in things like, again, galls and miners, leaf miners are one of his big, well, he was very interested in coming to my garden. He said, oh, can I cut off this leaf? Can I cut off this leaf? I'm going to try to hatch this. I'm going to try to hatch that.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen this. I've seen this in other plants in this family, but I've never seen it in this ornamental species of it, non-native species that I had in my garden. So he was fascinated
mm-hmm.
to see just what you're talking about, that not over thousands of years, but I guess when, if all else fails, they've decided to quickly adapt to eat something that was closely related. I mean, it must be chemically closely
yeah.
related to
yeah.
to the other species, yeah?
It has the chemistry that allows
Correct.
Them
yeah.
to recognize it as a host plant and survive.
Yeah.
You know, I wish when things got in trouble, they could say, okay, now we've got to change quickly so we can do what it takes to stay here. But let's use the monarch butterfly as a great example of
mm-hmm.
how that doesn't happen. You know, monarchs are declining. There's only 3.6% of their population left, essentially because we have removed milkweed.
Yes.
Which creates the millions of monarchs, particularly in the Midwest. So if things could adapt quickly when they're in trouble, monarchs would start to eat corn, or they'd start to eat soybeans, or they'd eat oak trees, or grass, or something that's out there. But that's not how it works.
Right.
And what's going to happen is the monarch will disappear long before it adapts to a different type of host plant.
Right,
so
right.
That's what specialization is all about. It really, really locks in those relationships. And specializing on one plant means you are unable to eat other plants.
Yeah. So nature, and again, way back when, before we intervened, using its native flora, it created these sort of layers of its architecture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I thought if you could just tell us briefly about the different layers, but then especially if we could delve into the one that I think is where a lot of the action is in terms of wildlife, is the edge habitat.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought we could talk about that a little bit.
Okay, well, think of your landscape as not two-dimensional, where it just has length and width. It also has height. It's a three-dimensional landscape. And in the east here, you have canopy. You've got, you know, tall trees that form a canopy. You have subcanopy, which are those probably the same species of trees, but they're not mature yet. Then you have understory trees, different species, which form yet a third layer. Then you have shrubs underneath that. And actually, in that shrubby layer, you have lots of very juvenile canopy trees just waiting for sun to open up. But what you have is vertical structure. And there are animals that specialize in terms of where they live, where they hunt, where they forage, in each one of those structures. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, you get to the forest floor. It's going to have all the perennials and the, you know, spring ephemerals and the leaf litter and the really complex soil organisms. And each one of those are vital layers to the complete ecosystem that we would call the eastern deciduous forest. As you move farther north, it's a coniferous forest, but you have the same structure.
Uh-huh.
In our yards, you know, particularly our suburban yards where we have some land, we've got property. We have come to worship the lawn, which is kind of unidimensional there.
I was going to say, speaking of one dimension.
Yeah, well, length and width, but no height to it.
Yeah.
And, yeah, we've got, you know, 45.6 million acres of lawn in the U.S.
45.6 million acres.
Yeah, that is eight times the size of New Jersey. That is dimensionless. So, and then when we put a tree in our yard, we stick it in the lawn.
Right.
And it forms a canopy, but there's nothing between the top of the tree and,
no transition.
And the ground. Yeah.
Right.
So our goal here is to build more functional landscapes. And there's several reasons we need to do that. We need to do that for watershed protection. We need to do that to save the biodiversity that runs our ecosystems, to sequester carbon, to do all these things. We need to put the plants back. So it doesn't mean we have to eliminate lawn. Lawn's a great plant to be able to walk on. So, you know, lawn goes where we walk. It can guide us through the landscape. But we need to put a lot more plants into our landscapes, and we need to do it not just two-dimensionally but three-dimensionally. And you talked about edge. Edge is a really productive part of all of these systems because you have all those vertical layers, but you also have sunlight. You don't have dark forest.
Oh, I see. Okay. So it's right.
And where you get sun, you get plants funnel the nitrogen. Nitrogen's always in short supply in plants, and they funnel that to the growing parts of the plant, which is the areas that are in the sun, and those are on the edge. So those happen to be the most nutritious areas. That's generating the most food. That's where the birds hunt. We call it an ecotone. It's a transition between, you know, two different types of
an ecotone. Okay.
Ecotone, yeah.
Because if I want to see the warblers in the morning, I know where to go. I go sit on the ground quietly at the edge, at the transition spots, and everybody sort of comes alive over there.
Yep.
You know.
Yep. And our you know, our suburban landscapes are ideal for edge because right now they're open.
You can only improve it. You can only... You can only go up from there, from where we are. Ugh, yeah. So kinds of some plants that you have used in your own landscape to sort of bolster that edge. A lot of these are shrubs and intermediate, the smaller trees, are they?
Well, they're small trees, but they're also large trees that aren't large yet.
I see.
So I talked about standing under the oak. We started from an acorn. We have hundreds of oaks on our 10 acres we either had them as gifts of small bare roots, and by small I mean, you know, a foot, or acorns that now we have to protect them from the deer until they're big enough. But these have grown well. We have, you know, red oak and white oak and, you know, several members of the red oak and white oak group. 25 feet tall is typical for the oaks in our property right now. They're going to keep growing. They're growing. Yeah, you know, I'm actually at the stage where I have to start editing because they have grown so fast that they're too close to each other in some situations.
Some of the things that I think of as edge also, and maybe it's not typically, but like the shad bush, the amelanchiers.
Right.
I love Lindera, the spice bush, and lots of interaction with animals. And also Cirsus, the red bud. I don't know if it's technically edge or not edge, but seems to.
I mean, You only get your I mean, cerise does fine in the understory. It just doesn't bloom
right
very well. So if you want your nice red blood blooms, and it's a great plant for early spring pollinators, because it's one of the first things to bloom, right when the very first species of bees are coming out. And you know, pollinators are important in our ecosystems because obviously they pollinate, but everybody worries about the decline of the honeybee, which is not a native bee. We bred it over to do
right.
most of our agriculture, but we have 4,000 species of native bees, and many of them are in big trouble, just like the monarch, but nobody's measuring that because we've taken away the flowering plants that support them. So one of the things we want to put back into our landscapes is a sequence of blooming plants.
Yes.
Right from spring.
Yes.
Through, you know, the decline in fall, because our native bees depend on a constant source of nectar and pollen.
Yes.
Not just, you know, one week of bloom. If you look at your property on any given week during the growing season and you don't have something in bloom, it's going to seriously impact any pollinators that try to live there, because where, you know, they have to eat every day.
Yes,
where are they going to go?
Yes,
they're not going to go 2 miles down the street.
So we only have a minute or 2 minutes or so left, and I just want to ask you, because you're a professional and expert entomologist and a teacher, so I want to become a better observer, and I'm trying, you know. So you mentioned it's so great that there's these guidebooks that are out
right.
now, and I've got more than can fit in one human being's house.
right.
What else? A hand lens? Or, you know, what do a binoculars? What should I have?
You know, if you have normal eyesight,
mm-hmm.
I wouldn't start with the tiniest insects where you actually need a hand lens.
Uh-huh.
What you want to do is develop what we call a search image.
A search image. Mm-hmm.
There are so many of the really interesting things in your yard that are blending in with their background. They are cryptic. There are a number of caterpillars, for example, in eastern red cedar that look exactly like the needles of eastern red cedar. But once you develop that search image, your eye is trained to see the difference between that caterpillar and the needles of the cedar.
Right.
All of a sudden, they start jumping out at you.
Oh,
And that just takes a little bit of a practice. You know, if you drop your contact lens on the floor, some people can find it right away. Other people never can find it because they don't have that search image.
Okay,
and that's what we're talking about. Most of the caterpillars, if you're looking for caterpillars, and most of the insects really are hiding under leaves.
Under leaves, instead of on top.
So you pick up.
Look up. Get underneath and look up. Okay.
And another really productive way to get to know the things that are living in your yard is to go out at night with a flashlight. So many things are on those plants at night that you don't see during the day. As a matter of fact, most of the things are out because, first of all, it's safer to eat at night because the birds are not hunting during the night. So those are little tricks that will expose you to a lot of the life that is the smaller life forms that are in your yard.
Well, you know where I will be tonight with my flashlight then. Out with my flashlight on the advice of Doug Tallamy, who's co-author with Rick Dark of a new book, The Living Landscape, which is a wonderful book. I'm going to buy a couple of extra copies to give away to readers. Doug, I'm so glad to speak to you. This has been so interesting for me. Thank you so
much.
Well,
thanks for the opportunity.
Yes, and I'll talk to you again soon, I hope. And thanks to all of you for listening. Don't miss an episode of the show. You can get it free by subscribing on iTunes, listen anytime, and also on Stitcher. I'll see you next week.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.